Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
The word of mouth.
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 Coming up on Word of Mouth, the online black marketplace. You'll need a hacker to get you to the Silk Road Online, but once there, you can buy just about anything.
They break it down into categories to make it easier for you. You know, there's cannabis, ecstasy, dissociatives, opioids, stimulants, benzos. And then there's just a category called Other.
Plus the swashbuckling 19th century naturalists who left the Age of Monsters behind to catalog life on Earth. And a pioneering neuroscientist rejects reducing the mysteries and motivations of human beings to mere responses in the brain.
Love isn't a response to a stimulus. It isn't even a state like being warm or cold. It's lots of things, and one would have to be a Martian not to recognize that love is about awe, guilt, jealousy.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of mouth is a many splendored thing and is coming your way after the headlines from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today on the origins of the species seekers, we'll hear about the dashing naturalists who risked their lives to catalog the natural world. Word of Mouth's 11 for 11 series of provocative thinkers unpacks biological determinism. And internet Sherpa Brady Carlson brings in his latest quarry of viral news and videos, from those intended by presidential candidates to those they wish would just go away. But first, you're no doubt familiar with the online retailers Amazon, eBay, and Craigslist for selling and swapping goods and services. We recently read about a site that caters to the shadier side of e-commerce. The Silk Road is an online black market where nearly anything can be bought and sold, from Afghani hashish to assault weapons to prescription meds, assuming you can find your way there. Freelance magazine journalist Sabrina Erdely wrote about the Silk Road for Rolling Stone magazine, where she is contributing editor. She's on the line with us to tell us what she found on the darker side of e-commerce. Sabrina, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
How hard is it to get to the Silk Road? I understand you needed the help of a hacker just to connect.
Right, I did. I know a hacker who acted as kind of a Virgil in guiding me into this whole underworld. Getting to Silk Road takes a little bit of technical know-how and patience, because it isn't a website you can access through your regular browser. Even if you have the web address, which is very forgettable, it's basically just a string of letters and numbers, if you plug that URL into your regular browser, like Internet Explorer or Firefox, it'll say the site can't be found. The only way to access it is with a software called Tor, that's spelled T-O-R, which is an anonymizing software. It lets users use the web without being traced.
Hmm.
This is a program that was not intended as a way to allow people to buy, you know, cocaine and M16s online. It was actually developed so that if you live in a country with an oppressive government, you can post things online or access information online without fear of repercussions.
And that's where opportunism sets in. So what does it look like once you get there to the Silk Road?
Well, once you get to the site, it's sort of hilariously cozy. It's true. The layout would be familiar to anyone who's ever shopped online, right down to the little shopping cart in the upper right-hand corner. And along the left side of the page, right where you'd expect it, you've got all the categories of things you can buy. And the site also has a feedback system, just like you'd find on Amazon or eBay, with ratings 1 through 5. So if you're curious about other buyers' experiences with a particular seller, you can just click on their comments. So the website isn't as polished looking as a professional legal marketplace, but anyone who's used Amazon or eBay would have no problem using Silk Road.
In fact, in your article, there's a little graphic from Silk Road Anonymous Marketplace, you know, drugs, 343 findings, you know, it lists ecstasy, psychedelics, opiates. It's really quite something. And then you can just add it to your cart. What are some of the things that are on sale on the Silk Road?
Oh, the things for sale, they run the gamut. There's every type of illegal drug you can imagine, first of all, and they break it down into categories to make it easier for you. You know, there's cannabis, ecstasy, dissociatives, opioids, stimulants, benzos, and then there's just a category called Other, where you can find you know, prescription medications, injectable steroids, you know, cheap cartons of cigarettes. There's also a weapons section where you can get machine guns and ammunition. There's a pornography section, and there's a forgeries section, too. When I was on there, in the forgery section, you could get a fake driver's license, a doctor's prescription pad, and there was even a seller who was claiming to have a fully editable UCLA acceptance letter.
Wowie. How does the site not get busted by authorities or the DEA?
Well, sellers feel fairly comfortable openly selling these things on Silk Road because the identities of buyers and sellers are completely obscured thanks to the Tor software. Tracing illegal stuff online back to its source is always a challenge for law enforcement, but this is especially challenging for the DEA because of the anonymity of Tor. It hides people's IP addresses. And then there are additional precautions that people take so that they don't get caught. I mean, for one thing, the site encourages sellers to creatively disguise their shipments and to vacuum pack their drugs so that they don't give off, you know, a suspicious odor and raise the suspicions from the FedEx guy. Also, there's another level of anonymity through the payment system because Silk Road doesn't accept credit cards or PayPal or any form of payment that can be easily traced.
All right, so what do they do?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because the site only accepts something called Bitcoin, which is a new virtual currency system. It's known as a peer-to-peer cash system, and it's generated by other computer users. And it was developed as an alternative currency to keep banks and governments out of the loop. So if someone's looking to make a purchase on Silk Road, first you'd have to go and change your money for some bitcoins, which you can do just like you're changing your dollars for a foreign currency. You do it online. There are a small handful of websites that will change your currency for bitcoins. And then you put the bitcoins into your Silk Road account, and it's like the digital equivalent of walking in with a paper bag full of cash.
We're speaking with Sabrina Erderly. She wrote about the online black marketplace, The Silk Road, for Rolling Stone magazine, where she's a contributing editor. Well, so far, we're giving people quite a little primer in using this. I mean, are you afraid that reporting on it is going to draw more interest to this black market site?
Well, I mean, like the site says, when you log on, you use it at your own risk. I mean, I would not recommend anybody use it. And the site does warn you. You know, when I first got on there, there's this gigantic warning saying this is an experimental site and they can't guarantee your protection from law enforcement or from other users. That certainly made me hesitate before I clicked agree. But I did, all in the name of research. Didn't buy anything, of course.
An anonymous administrator told you via email that they are a bright and honest and cooperative community. I mean, there's a real philosophical bent to all of this. What's behind that, Sabrina?
I would say that this is the point where libertarians and anarchists meet. You've got that libertarian bent where people say, you know, people should decide for themselves what they should or should not do, and government shouldn't stand in their way or dictate to them how they should go about their business. And then from the perspective of the anarchists, Silk Road represents the sort of lawless free-for-all where, again, government doesn't intervene and stand between you and what you want to do, whatever that may be.
Where do these products come from? Do you get any sense their origins on the site?
Yes, you can see on the site that it truly is a global operation. Sellers, when I went on the site, were claiming to be from the Netherlands, from England, from here in America, all over the world. And they appeared to be individual sellers. But there is a rumor that drug cartels are starting to dip a toe into the water and sell their drugs on there to try to get on this game. So when you're dealing with the sellers, you really don't know who you're buying from.
Well, do you see the Silk Road and other black market sites gaining popularity as most of the world goes online? I mean, is this where illegal business is going to take place?
I would say it was inevitable that the internet would be used as a black market. People were already using the internet to do all kinds of things with a certain feeling of anonymity. Now there's a software that promises true anonymity, and the gloves are off, and it makes the internet a true free-for-all for all the impulses that people have. So my guess is that, especially if law enforcement isn't successful in bringing down Silk Road, we'll be seeing more sites like this soon.
Well, Sabrina, thanks so much for that little illegal journey for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sabrina Erderly, a freelance journalist. She's written for magazines like Self and The New Yorker. She's also a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. You're going to find a link to her article, including that graphic I mentioned of the Silk Road interface. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And there's also a link to her website where you can read much more of her work. Late last month, students at Walcott High School in Connecticut were on lockdown. A morning announcement on the intercom warned of a threatening intruder. Doors were locked and police swooped in with dogs. Drug-sniffing dogs, as it turned out. There was no gun-toting maniac roaming the halls. It was a, quote, lockdown intervention drill, a ruse to clear the halls for a school-wide drug search. The story went largely unreported, if not for Rick Green, columnist with the Hartford Courant. Rick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
That was a brief sketch. Fill us in on what happened that morning at Walcott High. What were students instructed to do?
So picture this. Shortly after the day begins, there's an announcement that says that there's a dangerous intruder in the school. Immediately go to your, homerooms. And I guess they were directed to huddle in a corner of the room and stay away from the windows. Given what's happened in recent years, and you're a high school kid, what are you supposed to think here? Is there a madman in the school with a gun or whatever? And this goes on for about 10 minutes, and after about 10 minutes, there's an announcement that says, there's not an intruder. Actually, we have drug-sniffing dogs, and we're, looking for pot or heroin or whatever. And just remain in your classrooms, and when we're done with the search, you can go back to normal.
Did they find any drugs?
They didn't find any drugs.
Not at all.
No joints, no nothing.
Well, the police must have coordinated with this school.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it? Do you know?
I think this was a joint decision between the superintendent of schools and the police chief. Drug searches in schools and drug sniffing dogs in schools are not a rare event. It happens. Some schools do that. It's the combination of sort of tricking the kids that I think really, that's what rang my bell here, that, I've got an idea. Let's lie to these teenagers to try to gain their trust.
Any reason to believe that there were drugs?
No, I think it's a periodic thing where, when I spoke to the school board president and the superintendent, they said, it's part of our responsibility to preserve, drug-free schools and all of that. I got three teenagers. I'm all for that. But it seems to me that if you want teenagers to trust you, you don't lie to them.
Mm.
And they absolutely lied about arguably a fairly terrifying event here.
Yeah, and you did speak to some parents. I mean, the kids obviously freaked out. What did they have to say?
Yeah, I don't think there was any kind of mayhem freak-out situation. I think some kids were like, why are you doing this to us? I did speak to one parent who said, it's just the wrong message to send to kids, to make them think that there was an extreme danger situation.
I've read so much about what happened after Columbine and,
yeah,
of course, Virginia Tech. And, maybe even if there wasn't mayhem, like, kids remember this in a very,
right,
very fearful, kind of panicked and petrified way. Is it unfair to play on those kind of fears? I mean, it does exist in our cultural memory.
Well, I mean, I'd go further and say drugs exist. And the thought that you can have a drug-free high school is, I think, while admirable, is kind of absurd. So, this is what you get when you have this mentality that says zero tolerance and no drugs at all. So we got to sneak dogs in to make sure that there aren't any drugs. I don't want to check my rights completely at the high school door.
Well, Rick, we'll keep an eye on your column for sure.
Sure. Yeah, it's nice talking to you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Rick Green, a columnist for the Hartford Courant. That's where we read about the intervention lockdown drill that's at the high school in Walcott, Connecticut. And there is a link to the story at wordofmouthradio.org. And what do you think? No harm done? War on drugs gone a step too far? Or is this what we need to do to protect our kids? You can let us know at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page or on Twitter. Coming up, Internet Sherpa Brady Carlson brings in his latest quarry of viral news and videos, from those intended by presidential candidates to those they wish would just go away. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Well, that music, such as it is, means Word of Mouth's Internet Sherpa Brady Carlson is back with us. After his weekday shifts hosting All Things Considered, Brady likes to unwind by gathering new items for Here's What's Awesome. That's our frequent look at the web and its endless list of memes, trends, and viral hits. Brady, great to have you back.
I was going to think of a clever response to that, but it's...
You can't even...
I can't remember it. Sorry.
I think it's the Department of Energy is what you're looking for.
Oops.
Everyone's seen the viral video of the moment by now. This is Texas Governor Rick Perry's oops moment, if we need to remind you.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education,
And the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
Five.
Yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
I'm starting to feel sorry for the old chap. Another video has popped up of GOP frontrunner candidate Herman Cain having trouble answering a question about Libya. This was before an editorial board from a newspaper. These are the kinds of things a candidate, of course, will hope just never see the light of day. So what are they hoping that voters will look at?
Well, they have been producing a lot of videos, and some of them are more straightforward campaign ads, which more and more are simply being posted to the web and not being run as paid ads. They figure the media is going to cover them anyway, so why pay to, you know, you can get the same amount of exposure just relying on the media to cover it. Many of these videos are not 30-second ads, though. They're actually produced more like movie trailers. This site, Tech President, did something kind of funny. They took a series of these candidate ads and compared them to the trailer for the movie Transformers 3 and found they were actually more similar than you might expect.
Well, let's hear from one. This is by former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who is gaining in the polls.
The American people create jobs, not government.
Would you reappoint Ben Bernanke?
I would fire him tomorrow. I think the Fed should be audited. I'm not particularly worried about Governor Perry and Governor Romney frightening the American people when President Obama scares them every single day.
So, cue the dramatic music, a very cinematic approach. We've seen this kind of thing before, but it's certainly a world apart from viral video.
You know, it's not like 4 years ago when Mike Huckabee was making a video for the internet crowd with Chuck Norris trying to get some buzz there. This has been a little more conventional, but it's not necessarily innovative stuff. One thing that did catch my eye recently, there's a page on Herman Cain's website. It's the 404 page, the page you go when you click
when
on
you get
link.
An error.
Yeah, when you go to the wrong thing. And it says, like an Obama policy, this 404 page will get you nowhere. Whether you agree with the sentiment or not, it is a very webby, non-traditional campaign joke in a sea of mostly traditional campaign content.
Well, no matter what they do, they can't manage all of it, obviously. There's been a series of lip-syncing videos where candidates, you know, we see them making speeches, shaking hands, kissing babies, but their voices are actually filled in with just gibberish to match the lips, saying some pretty funny stuff. Here's the one of Herman Cain.
I can probably freak on you. It's just crazy. You know, we ain't never have this. An old rotten eagle's nest. Nachos and hogwash. This is my juice. And I'm hungry. McDonald's special. Give me a large plate. Then I'll sing,
It's just silly.
The bad lip sync folks started out by working on bands. They would take music videos and rewrite the songs to fit what the lips were saying. They very wisely moved on to politics.
All right, so that's all regular web fare here in American politics, but maybe not in Russia. Now tell us about Vladimir Putin's saucy new ad campaign.
Yeah, this is an ad you will not see from any of the candidates in the 2012 race in America. There's a couple of 20-somethings walk into the polling place. There's this sort of light techno music playing in the background, and they're flirting, and then all of a sudden they walk into the polling booth together. You don't actually see anything risque happening, but the message is very clear. You know, it's a vote for Putin means love.
Well, or something
or
like it.
Or something like that, yeah.
Well, Putin's been on this sort of YouTube branding campaign over the last few years. I mean, that video where he kind of saves the TV crew by shooting a tiger. Or him doing judo. I mean, is this what the Russian people are looking for in a leader?
I from what I know of Russian political culture, you can sort of build this larger-than-life brand of yourself. And Putin is sort of a small, balding guy with a, you know, kind of a high voice. It's probably a wise imaging move for him to show himself, you know, with a judo outfit on or shooting large game, things like that. You know, either that or he thinks he looks great without a shirt on, one or the other.
Well, and for those who want to save rather than shoot animals, there's just an amazing video on the Atlantic website of a team airlifting black rhino to a reserve. Now, they're doing this by helicopter. Just imagine the scene. These massive animals bound by their feet flying over the Serengeti to new areas where they will have larger areas to roam. Let's hear it.
And this is the kindest way we've yet discovered of moving a rhino from the field to a vehicle.
It is a big operation. It's a lot of animals to try and move in a really short time.
There are no roads. There is no access whatsoever. You know, most of these parks are wilderness area.
Now, of course, we do have links to for everyone to see these videos for themselves. But what's going on here, Brady?
This is another example of how wildlife groups have really used the visual side of the web effectively. They put together a lot of videos, photo slideshows, things like that, to raise awareness of conservation and animal issues. This is really high-quality stuff. This is a nice video. You're not going to confuse it with, like, the movie Operation Dumbo Drop.
All right. You've been following the Occupy Wall Street movement and its satellite protests for the past, 2 months, I guess, they've been active. Police have cleared out some of these encampments, like the one in Oakland, I think Portland, Oregon as well. Is it make or break time for Occupy?
If there is any change at all, I think it'll start to evolve. Anything that's web-based or viral like these protests are, they start to find new techniques, new things to do. We've heard a couple of them. One is called the mic check. It's a group of protesters who show up at a political event or a speech, and at a predetermined time, they interrupt the speaker. This happened to Michelle Bachmann not so long ago.
This will only take a minute.
This will only take a minute.
We have a message for Ms. Bachmann.
We have a message for Ms. Bachmann.
You may
have
And this also recently happened to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. A group of people interrupted one of his speeches. Actually, it was in Chicago, I want to say. The other technique was something in Harlem. It's actually a woman who was living in a building that was kind of run down. It needed some upkeep that the landlord apparently wasn't doing. The city was knew about it but couldn't get in to fix it. So the woman went to Zuccotti Park. She said, "I see a lot of activists here who are trying to change things. Why don't you come to my building and help me out?" So they actually occupied the boiler room in her building until the landlord allowed the city in to fix the boiler, and that did happen. So we may see more of those quick, direct action kinds of activities.
Well, let's end that with something that's weird, even for the things that you find online. A guy screaming at trucks?
I found this on BuzzFeed. I have no idea who it is or why it is, but he's found one of those DiGiorno pizza tractor trailers, and on the side of the truck it says, "It's not delivery, it's DiGiorno." It's a delivery truck. So.
All right, let's hear it.
It's not delivery, it's DiGiorno! You can't deliver DiGiorno! It says so right on the side of the truck!
Brady, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Virginia!
We do have links to everything that Brady mentioned. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can follow us and follow Brady on Facebook and on Twitter. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Welcome back.
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 This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 18th century, explorers set out to catalog the varieties of life on Earth. Until then, even educated people believed that monsters and creatures from mythology lurked outside the relative safety of their known environments. Today, there are 2 million documented species on Earth, a far cry from the 4,400 listed by Swedish botanist Carolus Linnaeus back in 1758. Even that number is astonishing, considering that the bold and great lengths a few ambitious men had to go to discover and catalog the mysteries of the natural world. The exploits of these colorful explorers play like adventure stories in a new book, The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth by Richard Conniff. Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, nice to be here, Virginia.
The first species seekers set out to explore the world in the Great Age of Discovery. So describe that time, that backdrop for us.
For these people, going out to distant corners of the Earth was more dangerous than going to the moon is for us. I mean, first of all, it would take 6 months or a year to get to some of these places. They stood a high likelihood of dying. So Linnaeus sent out 19 of his students. Half of them did not come back.
Well, there are 6 main seekers in your book. Some of the side characters are also very fantastic. So let's start with where you start in the book. This is at the height of battle with a certain Colonel Dijon. Tell us a little bit about him.
So he was in the French army, and it was during the Peninsular Wars in Spain. And he was also a coleopterist. That is, he collected beetles. So he was going into battle one day, and he had a challenge of charging uphill into the Spanish cannons. The air was full of gunpowder and blood and gore, and he looks down from his horse and he sees this beetle by a stream that he had never seen before. So he gets off his horse, collects it, pins it inside his helmet, and then gets back on the horse and says, "Charge." And in the ensuing battle, 600 of his soldiers died. his helmet was blasted to pieces, but he survived, and so did that specimen.
You write, in the 18th century London, this fervor that we just heard a little bit about manifested in some very strange journeys of exotic animals. Tell us, for example, why an eel was brought to London in a cask of rum.
So they actually shipped five of them from South America, and one of them survived to make it to London. And they were interested in it because it was electrical, and everything electrical was fascinating at that time, you know, Ben Franklin and all that sort of thing. And then they had a kind of party, a scientific party, where everybody gathered in this one house in London, and they had an electric eel, and one person grabbed it on one end and then held hands with 27 other people in a ring and grabbed it on the other end, and the electric shock ran through them all. And that was kind of a kick, kind of a thrill, and also told them something about the natural world that they hadn't known before, you know, that there was this electrical basis for these biological actions.
Well, one of my most favorite chapters in the book talks about the conundrum of what to do with a species once they have been collected. So enter Charles Waterton. How did he come to change this game?
So Charles Waterton was, like a lot of these characters, eccentric. And he was interested in species not so much to name them, but to bring them back to life, that is, to stuff them and arrange them in a way that actually reflected how they lived in the wild. So he spent enormous amounts of time looking at how a bird sat on a branch, for instance, and then trying to recapture that. And it was kind of like he was interested in reincarnation. Up until about the 1820s or 1830s, everything that you collected pretty much rotted away before too long. But about that time, arsenic came in and various other preservatives, and that made it possible to keep these things and build up large collections and make comparisons of one to another. And that really helped people understand a lot more about the natural world.
How did this sudden discovery of so many species affect the predominantly Christian, European, and American vision of God's individual divine creations?
You know, we tend to think of this as a story just about the discovery of evolution by natural selection. And really, it was a lot more profound than that. And one of the big changes happened in the end of the 18th century because of a species that had been discovered in the United States. It was they called it the incognitum, but it was a mastodon. And a French anatomist named Georges Cuvier used the mastodon and other specimens that he had of African elephants and Indian elephants and Siberian mammoths to demonstrate that the mastodon was in fact extinct. And that was a pretty profound shock because it meant that a part of God's creation had actually disappeared from the face of the earth. And up until then, everybody believed in this perfect chain of being where from the lowest creature to the highest, everything, every place, every possible place was filled, and everything was sort of designed to stay that way forever.
How many species are left yet to discover?
Well, that's a big subject of debate. So a recent study came out and said that probably we have 10 million species on Earth, so we have another 8 million to go. But others have said 50 million to 100 million. I think the point is that really, even after 150 years of discovery, 200 years, we know very little of the natural world. And what we don't know about what's disappearing all around us right now could actually be pretty critical information.
Well, fascinating story, and I really want to thank you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you, Virginia.
Pleasure. Richard Conniff, a Guggenheim Fellow, winner of the National Magazine Award and guest columnist for the New York Times. His new book is The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. You can find more on the book, including some terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget that you can seek us on Facebook and on Twitter. No life or limb required. If agriculture is cultivating food, apiculture raising bees, and arboriculture growing trees, then what the heck is permaculture? NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown schlepped up to New Hampshire's frozen north to talk to people who practice permaculture and found that the term contains multitudes.
This is Dee Acres, a teaching farm in Dorchester, New Hampshire, spitting distance from the White Mountains.
So my name's Keith Morris.
My name is Steve Whitman.
And I'm here teaching the Permaculture Through the Seasons Permaculture Design Certification course.
Coming towards the end of the second permaculture design course to be run here.
I came to get an answer to a straightforward question. What is permaculture? But the soundbite wasn't forthcoming. Ask six people and you'll get six responses.
My name is Teresa. Permaculture
to me is living in communion with your
environment. Obviously, there's many definitions of permaculture.
So permaculture to me is sustainable ecological design.
But in a nutshell, I would say it is integrating your life to become part of the natural
permaculture
system.
Is just that. It's simple.
At this class, the students, the teachers, everyone answers with dense, jargony boilerplate. But to break it down, it's about efficient buildings, waste management, saving and generating electricity, catching and using rainwater, and a whole hodgepodge of other topics. It's about smart, green systems that reduce the energy and resources that our lives require. But the best way to understand permaculture is to see it on the ground. Students at this weekend's class give us their favorite examples. First, here's Sarah Dunham.
Consciously thinking about my waste work, so I have worms, composting worms in my apartment. I try to make a lot of things by hand rather than buying them from somewhere. You know, if I can make it, I do.
And this is Jill Winton.
I would have to say the herb spiral is pretty cool. Basically, it's a mound of dirt to make a three-dimensional planting bed, and you can plant herbs that were, like, dry and hot near the top on the sunny side and plants that, like, cool and moist towards the back.
Permaculture is not just about agriculture. It's a school of design. And it's not just embracing trees and doing yoga in parks, though all that isn't incompatible with permaculture. Sometimes it can be about making money. Keith Morris talks about a test piece in class. It's a project in Milwaukee called Growing Power, which was started by former NBA player Will Allen. On a tiny 2-acre city plot, Growing Power is raising fish, bees, chickens, ducks, and goats, as well as growing sprouts, fresh greens, and herbs. There's a 250,000 worth of food in 2 acres of parking lot. And Morris says that when Allen got there, there was zero soil.
And they have a large and well-established composting operation where they're getting food residuals from all the restaurants and cafeterias and schools and supermarkets in the region, composting that.
In that urban waste dirt, the crew plants sprouts and greens that are grown dense, harvested fast, and sold for a pretty penny. The centerpiece of the operation are tanks of tilapia flanking greenhouses. They sell them for $6 a fish, but also...
What happens when you keep a ton of fish in a tank, like wall-to-wall, gill-to-gill? Well, they foul the water, like, almost immediately.
The fish manure water is pumped out of the fish tanks into vegetable beds. The veggies, incidentally...
By the end of the troughs, have it filtered, and it goes back to the fish in a constant recirculation.
It's permaculture. I asked Steve Whitman if permaculture is just common sense.
I think common sense is a huge aspect of this. Often we'll say at the beginning of a course that if some of this seems intuitive or like common sense, that's a good thing because you can't teach common sense, but there's a lack of common sense in a lot of decisions we make today.
Permaculture has been around for a while, but recently has started to wriggle into the mainstream. Gardens on roofs, food instead of lawns. Green building and houses that gather and store heat from the sun without any PV panels or hot water tubes. That's all part of it, too. But really, permaculture is putting all of this together, and Whitman thinks that that's what's so hard to grasp.
I think people can wrap their heads around aspects of it. People can understand the value of organic agriculture, or they can understand the value of the local food movement, or local products, or things that seem tangible. To look at the big picture and see how all these pieces may or may not fit together is probably more than the average person is willing to dig into initially.
But you still can't find many people who know the word. The people who drove all the way up here this weekend, they don't much care. They, like permaculture, are solution-oriented, and so haven't stopped to consider how long it will take for the rest of us to catch on. But if someone seeing what they're up to says, hey, that makes sense, it'll be fine by them. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
Yeah, it doesn't even give off any heat.
No, it's so efficient.
And for more about permaculture, dig into wordofmouthradio.org or check out the conversation sprouting on our Facebook page. Coming up, a pioneering neuroscientist takes aim at what he calls neurotrash, the proliferation of brain science hype, which he finds ultimately pessimistic. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Well, 10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more?
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout the year, we've been featuring a series we call 11 for 11, conversations with innovative thinkers who challenge and provoke new ways of approaching the biggest issues of our time. Dr. Raymond Tallis is a former clinical neuroscientist turned author. His book, Aping Mankind, targets what he calls neurotrash, the explosion of pseudoscience that reduces human behavior from believing in God to falling in love to pure physical impulses in the brain. In other words, exactly the kind of breakthroughs word of mouth frequently reports on. Now, we asked Jeff whether the emergence of reliable brain scan technology might rival DNA evidence in future trials. Here's what he said.
DNA is different. DNA isn't telling you what somebody thinks.
Does the brain scan of a psychotic person look different than that of someone who has a strong moral compass?
Take the psychopathy one.
A long-held understanding of how our brains actually store and then access memory. Tell us about direct access.
So the old model of memory was that the brain is a bit like a
hard drive. Example delivered by Professor Beatrice Luna. She teaches psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh and is a leader in the growing field of developmental neuroscience. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link. Well, Ray Tallis is taking aim at what he calls a kind of neuromania, this assertion and a belief that biological destiny, backed up by brain science, is now guiding several different aspects of our life, not only in the sciences, but daily life and social policy. And as you say, Ray Tallis, in the humanities, what's your concern there?
I'm rather amazed that the humanities, in a sense, have collaborated with pseudosciences. And there are many humanities now that embrace the application of neuroscience to human life in a way that really seems to undermine their own ethos. Neuroaesthetics says that if you want to understand art, you should look what happens to the brain of people looking at bits of art. Neurolaw says if you want to make appropriate judgments in the court, then you should do brain scans on people who are accused of crimes. Neuroeconomics says if you want to understand why we make such unwise decisions, then we should look at the balance between the frontal lobe, which is prudent and tells us wait for it, and the amygdaloid body says I want it now, and so on and so forth. And it's rather surprising in a sense that the humanities have embraced neuroscience in this way. One of the founding concepts of the humanities was that individuals have a dignity, that they are conscious agents, not automatons in the grip of biological or indeed physical processes.
But don't these things, you know, musicology, maybe theology, have some sort of grounding in biology?
I don't think so. And I always find the neurological investigation of music extraordinarily barren. In fact, most research into what the music does to the brain fails to differentiate not only between J.S. Bach, for example, and Amy Winehouse. They both basically stimulate the dopaminergic pathways, apparently. But it fails to distinguish between the response to drugs or even sexual stimulus. And it seems to me that a science that cannot differentiate between hearing an organ played and having one's organs played with can't tell you much about either.
Doesn't the idea of being biologically bound offer some hope for people, for instance, who suffer from mental illnesses, that they know that it is not a spiritual or moral failing on their part, but there is something with their brain that can be healed?
I think that's a really good point. It seems to me that when understanding mental illness, we have to see that it's got two facets. Clearly, there are differences in the brain in people who have schizophrenia. But that's not the end of the story. The person with schizophrenia very poignantly tries to make sense of what their brain is telling them. So the symptoms of schizophrenia are very personal. So to reduce schizophrenia to dysfunction of the brain doesn't do justice, if you like, to the heroism of a person with schizophrenia who is trying to make sense of the world despite what's happening. But the abnormality in the brain certainly is the underlying problem with schizophrenia. So you're quite right, the biological approach to mental disease is actually quite optimistic, so long as we don't reduce mental disease simply to its biological basis. And that's true on a broader front. We clearly have biological roots, we human beings. Most of the functions that I perform from day to day, whether it's, you know, eating or defecating or breathing and so on, clearly are biological. But that's not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. biological dysfunction of the brain is the beginning of the story. And when one respects the individual who suffers from schizophrenia, it's acknowledging that they clearly have this problem, which has a biological origin, but they themselves heroically are trying to make sense of it.
I read a review of this book in The Guardian that said you are attempting to rescue atheism from the atheists. And I wonder, is there something inherently religious or even spiritual in your argument that there is something more than just biology that drives us?
I've been accused of lots of things. I've been accused of having a religious agenda, which I don't. I've been accused of being a creationist, which I'm most certainly not. I sign up to Darwinism. And I've been accused of being a dualist, that I believe that we are kind of ghosts in the machine of the body, and I don't believe in that at all. My feeling is I'm just inviting people to look at what's in front of their nose, which is the most difficult thing, just to see how different we are from animals, and indeed to celebrate that, and also to acknowledge that our future is not something that can be explained by a biological script. The future lies in our own hands to shape. Humankind has been something that has shaped its own destiny rather than being shaped, as it were, by the biological prescription. And it's just saying, remember you have freedom. Remember that collectively and individually we make choices. Don't pretend for a moment that we are fated by our Darwinian heritage. There is evidence that we've actually broken away from biology. Of course, as a doctor, I know we are still organisms. You know, every time I eat a meal, I know that I'm an organism that requires nutrition. There's more to it than just nutrition. Meals are highly symbolic. The food I eat has been brought together from all the four corners of the earth and so on and so forth. So I'm just reminding people about the extraordinary, miraculous truths of humanity.
Is biologism the enemy of hope, to quote the title of your former book?
I think it is, if you think we are fated to enact a biological script. And some writers have made that very clear. I mean, there's a very eloquent political philosopher, John Gray, who said that we delude ourselves when we think we are different from animals. We delude ourselves when we think we can control our fate in the way that animals never do. In fact, if anything, we're not any animals, but we're terrible animals. And I think there is a profound pessimism built into the biological reduction of human beings. Some biologists would deny that. The brilliant primatologist Franz de Waal says we've got biological reasons for being cheerful about ourselves. You know, some chimps are jolly nice. But actually, if you look at the animal kingdom overall, most animals are jolly rotten to each other. They don't seem to fret over each other's fate. If you're trying to find sources of good cheer in the claim that we are be understood biologically, you've got to be terribly pick and mix as to which beasts you choose to think we've inherited our propensities from. We take the biological givens and run with them to places that are not envisaged in biology at all.
Simon Shorvin of the UCL Institute of Neurology writes that all neuroscientists should read this book. Do you think you've changed any minds?
I haven't changed probably any current minds that are in the ascendant, but I'm vain enough to think that I might change the minds of those who are emerging in future. I've always thought my lottery ticket was in the 22nd century.
Dr. Tallis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Raymond Tallis, former doctor and professor, now full-time writer. His works include The Kingdom of Infinite Space, Enemies of Hope, and most recently, Aping Mankind, which we talked about today. To find more on the book and Dr. Tallis, and to hear more of our 11 for 11 series of conversations, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Amid news of serious clashes between Occupy Wall Street protesters and police and Homeland Security agents on Thursday, this week a lesser conflict emerged from New York City. It's what you could call the revenge of the interns. The first lawsuit to challenge the practice of unpaid internships in more than 50 years comes from two interns who worked on the set of Black Swan. They're suing the film's production company for violating state and federal laws. The plaintiffs claimed that Fox used more than 100 unpaid interns for performing tasks from ensuring the coffee pot was full to taking lunch orders from the crew to picking up trash. Not exactly the learning experience they were promised.
The New York Times reports that former Black Swan intern Alex Footman, a 2009 film studies graduate from Wesleyan, said that the only thing he learned from his unpaid gig was to be more picky in choosing employment opportunities. Well, we can say with absolute certainty that interning at Word of Mouth offers a much more meaningful experience. If you'd like to volunteer or intern with us, we encourage you to fill out an application at the About page at nhpr.org. Around here, interns are an invaluable part of turning ideas into radio. No dry cleaning pickups, no orders for egg white omelets, and they are only asked politely to fetch coffee if they're already getting a cup for themselves. I'm Virginia Prescott. From all of us here at Word of Mouth, we are grateful for the time you spent with us today. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back next Saturday with more new ideas on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Virginia Prescott,
and Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson
and Courtney Kenya.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show,
to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment,
or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at Word of Mouth.
We should do like a thing where we go,
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Whoa, totally out of breath there. I'm going to try that again.